You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Ken June.
Hey, Bob. Good to be here. Good.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Ken June Q, the CEO of Imbue. I hadn't actually thought about the rhythm of that description. That you chose to found a company that rhymes with your last name. That was a good idea.
I never thought about that. Wow.
Yeah. No, you should go with that. We'll talk after the recording. You also. I was looking at your Wikipedia entry. So first of all, I gather you've raised at least $200 million. The company has from investors, including NVIDIA, a company that almost no one had heard of except for gamers 3 years ago, and now everyone has heard of. It also says you're the co-author of a book called So Electric, S-E-W, that uses sewing to teach computer science to middle and high school students, and you founded something called the Archive Long-Term Co-Living House in San Francisco. I hope we'll have time to talk about some of that stuff. I want to start out by talking about Imbue and the AI future you envision or hope to help usher in. I know you see Imbue as having a strong kind of mission, and there's an AI future that you would like to see, and you'd like to contribute to that materializing. And there's an AI future you wouldn't like to see. And you hope that your work at Imbue will reduce the chances of that unfolding. Can you start out by telling us, like, what AI future you don't want to see? And we're not talking, like, doomer-level stuff here. Maybe we'll have time to get to that question, too. But I'm thinking, like, 5 years from now, which presumably would be before any planetary takeover by a superintelligence, before the true doom scenarios, What would be kind of the worst, you know, the relatively bad version of the AI future? What would my life be like in the future you hope to avoid?
That's a great way to start off the conversation. I love it. I'll give the very simple answer that is not precise, and then I'll give a longer, kind of more precise answer. So the very simple, evocative answer is I want to avoid the WALL-E future.
Ooh.
So if you've seen WALL-E. All of people sitting in these chairs, they have lots of abundance in that world. The world is producing plenty of abundance. They have amazing technology, floating chairs, screens, and everyone has no agency. And people have no sense of self-determination. And I think, you know, when you watch WALL-E or when I watch WALL-E, my immediate reaction is, ooh, something is missing. Now, it doesn't mean there are some really good things about that world. I think abundance is wonderful, but something really deep about humanity is missing from that future. And so when I think about and you had a reaction. Do you want to share?
No, I just quite agree. I mean to invoke another movie, my worry about what AI will do is that it will be a little like The Matrix, where these guys are in pods and having hallucinations pumped into their brains, except that it will be voluntary. In other words, it's like the next step after WALL-E. And WALL-E, as I recall, they're like sitting in these lounge chairs, drinking soda and so on. And, you know, AI permits, in principle, a future where you live in a virtual reality that it could be very seductive, right? Right. And that path, I think, ultimately leads to a Matrix-like future. So that's, anyway, proceed. That's,
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analogy. I think the way I think about it is we live in a world, as of the past 50 years, where software is, and the digital built environment is a huge part of our lives and has become a huge part of our lives, as you said, you know, a virtual reality. And, I actually think in many ways that's wonderful that it's kind of unlocked this intellectual depth and access and communication and information processing that we weren't previously able to access. And I think when it comes to AI, like AI, this is a serious technology. And we are treating computers that can, you know, you can argue how much or how little they can reason and think, et cetera. But at the end of the day, like, I think in a few years, they'll be human level across a wide spectrum of capabilities and superhuman across a wide spectrum of capabilities. Mm. And that's real. That technology, this is a step function change in what kind of technological capabilities we have in the world. And I think for me, the thing I think the most about is right now there are a lot of narratives in the world about the future with AI in it. And those narratives are typically centered around the AI, and they're centered around automating things and delegating things to the AI. They're centered around how smart the AI will be and how it will know things and be able to tell us things and teach us things. And it really puts the AI at the center, not the human at the center. And mm-hmm. I think there's something very important about creating a world where, like, humans, as humans, we co-evolve with our technologies and our tools. And creating a world where humans are at the center and these systems are tools that are helping us, enabling us and giving us more agency, autonomy, ability to determine our lives and what we call maybe liberty. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, that's a very important thing to work toward. As an example of a way in which this gets reduced, even today, TikTok is a really good example of an AI system that kind of like controls us. Many of us have developed immunity against it, but some of us haven't. And, you know, I often hear of people who are friends who are like, I deleted my TikTok app because like for a few days I would open it. And then 3 hours later, I would discover that 3 hours went by.
I deleted it like within 2 days of first experiencing it. And I haven't been back. It was obvious that this was death. This was going to be death for me. I've since actually deleted even my Twitter app, and one of the smartest things I've ever done. I mean, I still do it on a computer, but that's a good kind of balance, is just mm-hmm. to keep it off the smartphone. Anyway, no, you're right. TikTok is like, they've got us figured out.
Yes. And the smarter systems are, like, the more data people have, the more, you know, the incentive of a third party developer right mm-hmm. now is to extract value from their users. And that's kind of just the world we live in today. And so I think it's actually really important to be very realistic about, okay, this is the world we live in today, where there are these incentive structures that would result in basically humans being algorithmically extracted from. And now these algorithms are getting much smarter, and they mm-hmm. can be really smart and funny and thoughtful and a good girlfriend and all of these other things. And, you know, that leads to a future where humans are kind of the object and no longer the subject. Mm-hmm. And I want a world where humans are the subject, because the thing that AI doesn't have that humans do have is drive, taste, a desire to create things that are beautiful and experience awe and find meaning. And mm-hmm. I think, those are important things.
You know, it's interesting, a little background. You and I met at a dinner in San Francisco. And one reason I asked you then if you could spare the time to be on my podcast is you said something that surprised me, just because you are like an AI exec, which is that, you know, I think I had brought up the question of like, what happens when AI companies optimize for engagement, just mm-hmm. try to keep you like, you know, glued to the stuff as long as possible, because that's their revenue model, as it tends to be with like an advertising model, maybe. And of course, it's that logic that has created the social media algorithms, including TikTok. And you were very much like against, I gathered, tell me if I got it wrong, but against that being the aspiration of AI executives to optimize for engagement, even though some business models do naturally lead to it. So that really struck me as being, is it in fact unusual among AI executives to denounce the idea of optimizing for engagement? Because that's what leads to Wally World, right?
Yes. I think the answer is complex. So I think in businesses where content is what they're producing, those businesses tend to optimize for engagement. The more engagement, the more ads they can sell. So ads-driven businesses mm-hmm. do optimize for engagement. Almost every tech company has some kind of engagement metric. Maybe it's daily active users, weekly active users, something like that. And in some companies, it doesn't seem to be bad for users. So Figma is a design tool, or like Dropbox. These are tools that do optimize for engagement, but it's not, I don't feel really bad about my use of Figma. And it's because Figma as a tool puts me at the center. It makes me the subject. I'm the creator. I'm creating and consuming things on Figma that I'm empowered to kind of create, adjust, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Whereas the businesses where optimizing for engagement feels really bad is places where I'm not the subject, I'm the object. I'm kind of being hung on to in order to continually consume. Right.
So the question is kind of, is engagement like kind of a numbing thing, or is it an engaging thing? In other words,
is it real engagement, you know, yeah, in a way?
And, you know, of course, I mean, the key word here in at least one sense, you know, is agency. Mm-hmm. You know, are humans going to be able to preserve their agency in the age of AI? And of course, this year has been more or less officially declared to be the year of agentic AI. I mean, that's kind of going to be apparently the official buzzword, you know. And I've got to give you credit for being ahead of the curve in a couple of senses. First of all, I know some time ago, a couple of years ago, when you were talking about your company's mission, first of all, I think you were saying, you know, look, if you want true artificial intelligence, just scaling up the large language models as they exist is not going to be enough. You're going to have to build in reasoning power, I think, right? And that's one thing that Imbue does. And that has turned out to be the case. I mean, that's the story of the last, the media has like, you know, that has turned out to be the case the last 3-6 months. That's been the story come out of Silicon Valley. Scale alone in training is not doing it. We've got, you know, OpenAI has a model with some explicitly designed reasoning stuff. Google kind of does. And then the other thing is, you were talking about agency before it was cool, and you were viewing your company's mission as building agents, although maybe not necessarily in the sense that we think of them. And I want you to talk more about that, because of course it's, you know, there is this double-edged sword with the AIs being the agents. You know, do they engage us? In the process of engaging us, do they sap our own agency? Or do they not? And, I'm not sure how easy it is for me personally to relate to what you're doing, because as of now, if I've got it right, your company is largely doing agents that help people with some conversancy in computer programming, or do I have that wrong?
That's right. Yeah. So kind of going from high level to the details of what we do. We started Imbue in 2021, and the purpose was, how do we make, my co-founder and I really believe, like, we can get a lot more out of our computers than we can get today. And there's this dream of the personal computer. And that dream was that the computer would be truly personal, that I could make it do whatever I wanted it to do every day, day in and day out. And we really felt like, okay, software agents that are smart and able to serve us and do kind of things that we want to do, maybe at scale, maybe help us process data, maybe help us find music that we really like, et cetera, that could unlock for us a lot more choice, agency, and creativity. Mm-hmm. And when we first started the company, we thought of agents in the way that today most people think of agents, as this kind of personal assistant that mm-hmm. you give tasks to, and it's like Siri or her, and it'll do stuff for you, and it'll be really knowledgeable about what it can and can't do for you, and it'll ask you questions. And we really actually went down that path thinking about, okay, how do we have this agent assistant thing? But, you know, as we went down that path, we learned a lot. And I think what I'm about to say is pretty controversial, but maybe in a few years it won't be. Just like a few years ago, we talked about agents. I think actually using agents as assistants is very difficult for people. And this is because delegation is very difficult for people as a paradigm. Like, you know,
you're talking to the world's worst delegator. Ask anybody who's ever worked for me.
Exactly.
I want to maintain control of all.
Yeah, totally. I want to maintain control too. Like, even I struggle so much to delegate as an executive. And I have to specify a lot of things up front. I really need to trust the person or the system that I'm delegating to. And so we really shifted our mentality and we really started to think about, okay, right now people think of agents as these things you delegate to, but what is a powerful, what are agents really? And like, what are, like, how can we have agents that are actually, that feel good to use? Mm-hmm. And that like feel like they're giving us power. And what we realized is if you think about what an agent actually is, an agent is this intermediary between you and your computer, because you're giving it stuff, it's talking to you or it's interfacing with you. And it's also interfacing with your computer to get your computer to do stuff. Mm-hmm. And the most general way for an agent to interface with your computer is by writing code, because that's the language your computer speaks. And so agents, a different way to think about agents, and I wonder if we'll, you know, use the term differently in the future, is as a higher level programming language, essentially, for you to be able to write code in a more natural form, whether it's a natural language or some other way of instructing your computer to create things. And so
we will all be software creators without having to know code in this, in your ideal world?
Perhaps we'll all be software creators. I think that there'll still be, you know, creating software is a complex thing, and mm-hmm. especially creating powerful, complex software. And so you would still have to understand, if you were a creator, you'd still have to understand, like, how do systems work? And can I, like, assemble them together? But I suspect that just like today, if you're building software, you can rely on many components and libraries that other people have built. In the future, even if you're not that familiar with how to build software, you can rely on components that other people have built, and there will just be more and more and more software that is easier and easier to create. And we actually, you know, going back to human agency, earlier we talked about engagement and when is engagement good and when is engagement not good for agency. I think mm-hmm. When we think about engagement as a thing that's encouraging a creative process, that's when engagement actually feels quite good. It's like active. Whereas passive engagement, or something is kind of being put into us, that is not necessarily a thing to optimize for. And so when we think about our tool, like what it's doing is it's enabling people to actively create with this medium that is AI, that is their AI on their computer writing code.
Mm-hmm. So how do you kind of, to oversimplify the question and kind of personalize it, how do you hope somebody like me will be spending their time in 5 years? I think you see, you know, much more powerful AI tools being at our disposal in 5 years. It sounds like in less than that, probably. How do you hope, is there an example of how you hope my day will begin or my day will proceed?
Yeah. There are some very trivial examples I can give you, but I think generally it's hard to imagine the future before it happens. Our imagination, you know, historically our imagination has always been very limited, like faster horses. But some examples of faster horses are, like, if you spend a lot of time processing your email, then you could have something that goes through your email and filters out stuff that's obviously, you know, spam. I get a lot of spam. Mm-hmm. Or you could have something where you tell it, like, okay, these are my priorities this week. Like, please don't surface things that don't fit within my priorities, or like surface them first. Mm-hmm. You could have it start drafting responses based on your priorities, things like that. That's like email triage. Another example is,
That you can do pretty much right now, right? I mean, you can do a version of that right now.
You could build that for yourself today. Right now,
quite off the shelf, but probably will be by the end of the year.
It's not off the shelf, but I actually think one thing that's very interesting about this idea of, we call it kind of personal software, mm-hmm. is part of why email clients don't do this today is because most people have very different ways of processing their email. It's actually hard to build software that's universal and covers every use case. And right. So this is actually a pretty good example of software that you want to be personal to you, that you're actually going to adjust. One of our other team members, Matt, he built a little, he's not a software engineer, he's our head of policy, but he studied computer science a long time ago, and he built a to-do list app for himself because he was quite frustrated. He really wanted to see kind of his big picture goals and have to-do items under those goals. So he built that for himself, and he's been actually iterating on it as he's been using it, and it's gotten to something that works well for him. Now, that's like very personal software, but you could also imagine building software for your community. For example, he's now building an app for his dad, who delivers a lot of casseroles to folks who are in need of food. And his dad spends a lot of time communicating and things like that, and none of that process is automated. And so when making software is much easier, much cheaper, we can make it for ourselves, but we can make it for our friends, our community, our family. And that kind of makes our computers much more bespoke to us and our kind of like allow us to harness that computational power. Now, that's the like immediate faster horses imagination, but you can imagine a much more powerful version of this, where actually what we are doing is distributing the power of AI. So AI, like these systems, these are big models. Today, they're very centralized. And in the future, I expect much of software to incorporate some element of these models, whether it's like their ability to process data and reason through it or something like that. And I think what we want is for people to be able to harness these models for themselves and perhaps have access to models that are more tailored for them. And also that are not just like centrally controlled, and maybe that can do more specific things that they want to do. And so there's also an element of like enabling people to, we call it create their own agents, because agents are just software.
Yeah. Maybe we should talk a little more about agents, because it's a word that, that means, as you suggested, different things to different people. I mean, when you, you know, when you ask, okay, what are the agents that are about to show up in 2025, the year of the agent, you hear about, you know, well, you can tell them to go book your flight, or at least set it up if you want to be the one who pulls the trigger. Maybe they won't, you know, go ahead and make the payment, or they'll fill your Amazon shopping cart. There was an example when Anthropic unveiled its computer use function, which permits, you know, the AI to kind of take control of your computer and do stuff. Of them, I think they said that they had, while sitting around, several of them had said, you know, order food for a group of people like us. And it chose, it sounded like it chose pepperoni pizza from Papa Joe's. That is agency. If you're actually, you know, choosing what kind of food. I mean, I must say that in general, I haven't yet heard of things that seem likely in the super near term that strike me as all that valuable. It's like booking flights, ordering food. You know, I guess I don't do all that much of those things. But of course, as you said, AI is going to get smarter and smarter. And it will be more and more like having a human assistant. So I guess... I guess I have a couple of questions. One is, how soon do you expect it to get kind of amazing, more amazing than filling our Amazon shopping cart if we've told it what we want? Like, I want the lowest priced aspirin. And also, I'm curious about how I think you see, although, as I said, you make these, I guess you could call them agents that help people who already have some conversancy with computer coding do better work. I gather you see that in evolving into something that is useful more and more to people who don't have that specialized knowledge. Is that right?
Yeah.
Like, so as I said, you know, in principle, I mean, we're already seeing examples where they say, look, you can just create this website without knowing code using AI. I haven't really tried it, but they say it's possible. I'm skeptical that we'd get a great result if I tried it. But so I guess you can go either way, either whichever you feel more comfortable with, either trace the path of agentic evolution generally in some direction, or maybe imbue's own path. Like, what is the what's the version of your product down the road that you know, works for a you know, kind of a tech illiterate or at least a non-coder like me?
Yeah, great questions. I'll start with the first. I'll answer both. I'll start with the first question, which is kind of, you're asking really like, when do agents become magical? And my answer to this is actually, agents are not new. We already have them. Agents are just software. And so the Facebook recommendation feed, newsfeed, is an agent. That system is making decisions about what you see every day. Your computer has lots of agents on it running all the time that are making decisions about what to, you know, do. And so, or similarly, you know, there's a system that makes decisions about parole in the judiciary system, and that is agentic, that's making decisions. So agency in software is not new, and a lot of software is already agentic or was already agentic even before this wave of AI. And I think a way to think about agents is not as this magical new thing, but rather as just like more powerful software that is able to make more decisions that make slightly more sense incrementally over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these systems, they will be able to make good decisions in very narrow domains better than in very broad domains. They'll be able to make better decisions if they know your preferences. They will be able to make better decisions if they have a smaller task, just like with humans. And so I think what we'll see is actually, you know, there's a tendency toward wanting to like have a magical agent that just knows us. But I think actually the more interesting products that will be built in the next couple of years are ones that really take this technology, the language models or other multimodal models, and incorporate that into a system that is thoughtful about how to apply the intelligence, as opposed to just asking the model to magically do something like order food and make good decisions about what food I want, because of course I have some preferences about what food I want. And I think the other thing you'll see is you'll see many more of these very vertical specific agents, like flight booking. Maybe it will in fact automate steps of the process, and that's awesome. Like, there are steps where I have to click through a bunch of buttons. It's really annoying. And like the UI is terrible. And
there's a lot of bad UIs in the world.
There are a lot of bad UIs. Exactly. And fundamentally, it's just about, you know, I think one of the things that we believe is fundamentally software agents are about data. And they're about being able to process that data and present it to the user in some way, or allowing the user to process the data in some way. So for flight booking, it's like getting data about what flights, and then it's making some decisions or helping you make some decisions about which one you want. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the core of the problem. Your second question was about, I think, like, how does Imbue think about building agents and enabling people to build agents? And what does that like progression toward less and less technical users look like? And there are a couple ways that we think about this. So today, our tool that we're working on, it's in private alpha, and we kind of are trying to use it ourselves. Our tool that we're working on, it's focused on how do we make changes to software, like create small pieces of software, make changes to pieces of software. Mm-hmm. And the reason, let me think about how to explain this to an audience that is not engineers.
I can help. Hopefully. I will react as they would react, because I am one of them. So I can ask the follow-up question.
So let me actually give you an example of why you think this website building app is not useful. So I've used a lot of these website building agents and built myself an app. And the issue is actually the first app that it builds is kind of like roughly right, but it's not quite right. And what I want to do, and the thing that you're always doing in software, is you're making changes. And in software development, the kind of like the social processes of software development, we call this like creating features, or we call it debugging or fixing a bug, or we call it writing a new commit, kind of like a new change set. And so that's the fundamental core of building software, is making changes to a chunk of code to get to the next version of it that you like or that you want more. Mm-hmm. And that really is the fundamental activity. It's not actually building the app. And I think that's a mistaken belief that a lot of people have, that like, oh, it should be this end-to-end process where you just like get an app at the end. But no, I think we take very seriously that in the world today, we as a society have learned how to build software. And it's not just about writing code. It's actually very much about the sociological processes around the writing code, which is like writing a spec document to describe what the feature should do, and figuring out what's called the data model, and figuring out how to architect it, and then writing the code, and then testing the code, and then committing it once the whole feature is done, so that now that feature is complete, and then you can move on to the next feature, but you can always roll back to the previous feature. There are all of these sociological components of software development that we kind of bake into what we're working on.
So in your vision of the future, is kind of part of the creative part of being human that saves us from Wally World, the kind of ongoing amendment of your agents? In other words, like the crafting of your own personal environment of agentic
yes.
support and the ongoing amendment of it.
Is exactly. That- like uh-huh. the ability to craft your environment and modify it as your world changes, in the same way that I'll modify my house pretty often. I'll add new objects. I'll move things around. I want to change it to satisfy what I want to do next. And I think your digital environment should be the same. And in particular, and I really like the way you said it, the agents, the kind of like software agents that are working with you or working for you and the pieces of software you're using, you want those to be changeable as well.
Mm-hmm. So the future you don't want to see is like me just buying some off-the-shelf, completely immersive virtual world video game that features these autonomous AI characters and is for that reason very engaging. Well, engaging in a bad sense. I mean, it's seductive. And maybe, I guess, worst case scenario is there aren't real people in the game. There could be. My friends from college who live halfway around the world could, in principle, be in that world. And that seems like that would be kind of cool. But I guess in the worst case, they're not. And I'm just sitting there like doing bong hits, as we used to call them, I guess, like vaping, whatever. And that's the worst case. Is that the worst case, or does it get worse? I mean, of course.
It can be much worse in many ways.
Give us a worst scenario. I'm looking for a worst scenario.
Yeah. So I think that worst case that was just described, I think that case is actually a little bit unlikely for most people, because people will be like,
"Yeah, I was just speaking about my own preferences there."
Totally, but I in that like I'm not sure people would adopt that product for a super long time. Maybe some people would, and that's a bad thing. But I think the real worst case is that we systematically but slowly and incrementally lose our agency, and we don't even realize it. It's like living in an autocratic country that becomes slowly more and more autocratic, and we forget that previously we had more freedom. So an example of this, I think agency, we talked about human agency earlier. Agency has feedback loops. You can gain a lot more agency over time, and you can also lose a lot more agency over time, called learned helplessness. And as a human, some of us, I had a lot of experiences. I was very fortunate. I had a teacher who actually gained a lot of agency through working with that teacher and kind of learning about myself and learning how to learn. I played a video game where I gained a lot of agency by building a clan. But it's also very possible to lose a lot of agency. So an example is there was a study about people who graduated during financial crises. And they followed these people 10 years later and looked at their average salary, and looked like their average salary actually 10 years later was still quite a bit lower than people who graduated in non-financial crisis years. So I think this is like 1989, 2008. And that's an example of learned helplessness. You kind of like learn like, oh, I am not something. I'm not capable. I'm not, et cetera. I can't do this. And I think, it's very sneaky. That's the worst case. It's very sneaky, and we forget that actually, we can make changes. We can create a different world. And I think we live in America, and America was founded on an idea of agency in a lot of ways, like liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And it's, I think, easy to slowly erode our freedoms and our liberty. I gave TikTok as an example earlier of something that kind of like subtly erodes, maybe not so subtly, but subtly erodes agency. And I think we could live in a world where we are kind of being bombarded by other people's software, and we don't have the ability to kind of create our own or to use ones that we really want to use, mm-hmm. and that our attention gets controlled and we lose agency over time. And I think this is the default path, is that the powerful become more powerful, and that the power of AI does not necessarily get distributed equally, and also that the power of AI kind of enables certain people more than others. Mm. And I think, like, yeah, that's the default path, is kind of like a rise and a widening of that gap.
So that's why you emphasize our role in creating our agentic environments, because you think if we surrender that, then we will be controlled by big corporations or autocratic politicians or some centralized source of power.
Exactly. Because there are things that become very easy in this world. For example, surveillance becomes very easy. You can mm-hmm. now collect a lot of data and process it really fast. And so in the same way, like, kind of the default path leads to more surveillance, more powerful technological systems that are centralized. There's also like real economies of scale to these mm-hmm. AI systems, where you train larger models and they get better. And so it's actually really important to fight against that default path by developing technologies that explicitly give power to people, creative power to people. Actually, a really good example of this is in the 1960s. In the 60s, this is right before the personal computer revolution, people were really excited about supercomputers. They were like, mm-hmm. supercomputers are the future.
Cray was the big brand, as I recall.
Exactly.
C-R-A-Y.
Yes, Cray.
Mm. The most powerful computer in the world, which is I'm sure less powerful than some smartphones now, but they filled like a room. But anyway,
exactly, they filled a room. There were these huge mainframes, and people were like, the future is going to be time sharing on supercomputers. Like, that's the direction it's going to go. And when people started building these little hobbyist computers and calling them personal computers, everyone made fun of them, because people were like, this is like a toy use case. No one's ever going to use this thing. And it actually took a lot of invention to make personal computers usable. It took Xerox PARC inventing and SRI inventing the GUI and the mouse.
I was just thinking about that the other day, the fact that the people at Xerox didn't get it. They had invented what we now know of as the desktop interface, the graphical user interface. And Steve Jobs shows up and is like, yeah, I see an application for this, but the people who invented it didn't. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, thank goodness Apple got it. Thank goodness Steve Jobs got it. But it still, you know, took that small group of researchers to like figure out, how do we make this technology usable by people, by regular people? How do we empower people with it? Mm-hmm. And the whole philosophy was kind of like, how do we augment human cognition? How do we augment human ability to think and to create and to understand information? And that was the driving philosophy. And I think, like, the future is not written. It's written. It's like written by us. It's not predetermined. It's written by us. Mm-hmm. And if we go into the future with this default philosophy of, okay, we're going to let market incentives keep going, and we just make these systems more powerful, and this will make the world more abundant, and that's good because abundance is good by default, like, that's not necessarily going to lead to the future we want. I think we have to be very, very intentional about creating systems that empower people, and that actually give that power to people, and that requires invention and imagination.
So your concern is that because AI potentially can be so seductive and persuasive, and it's already demonstrating considerable persuasive powers in actual experiments, it's been shown to be better in some cases than actual human beings in getting people to change their minds about their political views. And the concern is that, you know, that power, if used to sap your autonomy and centralized, right? I guess you're saying we all need to resist, in a certain sense, the control via AI, in part because maybe that's an inherently more impoverished life if you don't have any agency, but also because the influence you're surrendering can, in principle, be consolidated by some centralized force that's bad, right?
I think roughly right. I think just worlds that are more model culture uniform are a little bit more brittle, and worlds that are more pluralistic are perhaps more interesting. And, uh-huh. you know, this is why we see democracy having such interesting effects on the world is kind of why the internet has seen such interesting effects on the world. So,
and that's, you know, leads to something I've kind of thought, which is that ultimately, I mean, you know, it does matter, like what tools are made, and regulation matters, and all these things matter in terms of whether power will be consolidated or will be decentralized. And of course, there's the open source question, which has, you know, it's a double-edged sword, open source. But it does have the virtue of decentralizing power. That's the upside. Anyway, there's all these kinds of policy decisions and technology decisions you can make, but how much of it ultimately comes down to whether we are good at like cultivating our own character. I mean, you said you had a teacher who was very valuable in kind of cultivating your agency, I gather. And I almost think that to a large extent, this is a mission for the teachers and the spiritual leaders and so on. And even as I say, spiritual leaders, I want to issue a warning, like there's going to be bots out there trying to get you into some crazy cult. Okay. Be careful, you know, but, you know, I guess I'm saying to what extent is it really up to us to all of us individuals, to just make wise choices and exercise certain kinds of self-discipline and self-cultivation?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the answer is both. Like, defaults matter a lot. You know, I was born in China. I moved here to the US when I was 6. Mm. I often think about my life and my belief system would be totally different if I grew up in China. And it's because the defaults there are so different. And so, you know, I think part of like the reason we started in Bu was we want to live in a world 30, 50 years from now that we want to live in, not a world we don't want to live in. And, I think there are a couple of pieces like to that world. One is like, I think the narratives and the stories we tell about the future matter a lot. And this is why I'm excited about this podcast. Like your podcast, you talk about different stories of the future that are thoughtful about some of these questions. And, you know, I want a much more human-centric narrative of what AI can be for us that is much more centered around our creativity, our ingenuity, and our ability to self-determine and to support our ability to determine our own lives. I think pragmatically or like mechanistically, there are also other defaults that are possible. So for example, you talked a little bit about open source, and open source is actually a really interesting movement because like in spite of software in the last 20, 50 years being incredibly expensive to build, we actually rely on in our businesses and in our day-to-day lives quite a bit of stuff that is built upon open source software, like the Unix operating system and many, many libraries, you know, these programming languages, et cetera, are all open source. And I think we're going into a world where actually code is going to be much easier to read and write by machines and by us. And when I imagine a future in which, you know, our digital environments are not centralized and maybe they are more empowering, one world I can imagine is one in which kind of like, I was thinking about like, what kind of good futures exist? You know, how could this future look good? And one example of a potentially good future is one in which the vast majority of software we rely on is actually in the public commons, is maybe a public good. And it's easy for us. We have the tools to create, remix other people's, and to contribute back to that commons. And that maybe a lot of our stuff, you know, we talked about earlier, being able to make changes in order to suit us and suit our lives and to suit our community, you know, if we could take things from the public commons and remix it in order to create our digital world, then that feels perhaps more palatable and also safer than relying on maybe software that's like created by just one organization or like very, very much proprietary software. And perhaps that gives us as a collective more control, more power, more agency over our digital lives.
Okay. The as regular listeners and viewers know, at some point we go into what I call overtime, which is a part of the conversation available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. It's easy to become one. You go to Nonzero on Substack, and then you can, first of all, if you go to the post that where this this podcast is posted, you can watch or listen to the whole thing, but also you can set up your own podcast feed that will forever entitle you to listen to the overtime segments. And you have been kind enough to say you'd stick around for this. I really appreciate it. And I want to take the opportunity to get into some maybe a little more political territory. And if we have time, ask you about that co-living thing.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll start with that. The kind of, I think it's well known in some circles, this thing you set up. But I wanted to give you a chance to say anything else you want to say. First of all, about Imbue, where, I mean, if people Google Imbue, there's, you know, resources about what it is you're up to and so on. And I think you guys have a blog. But what else do you want to say about your mission or anything?
Yeah, I think for listeners of this podcast, you know, we released a toolkit for training very large models. So we trained a 70 billion parameter model, and there's a toolkit for infrastructure, et cetera, that others can use. That's kind of one of our moves toward seeing how much we can democratize of this technology. There's also, you know, we will be working on kind of a product this year and perhaps bringing it out into the world. And so anyone who has software engineers, feel free to sign up on our mailing list, and we will let you know when we have updates. But I think for everyone else, it's really worth thinking about what is the future we want to live in with AI. This is a very powerful technology. And how do we create a future that is centered around people and not kind of where people are not a future where people are subject to these systems, institutions, and machines that we don't have very much control over.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, thanks again to you for coming on and for continuing the conversation. Thanks everybody who has listened this far, whether or not you're going to follow us into overtime, although I hope you will.